Mr. Ambassador, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure for me to welcome you all here this evening to a panel discussion which is part of a two and a half day conference we had on the same topic, which is European remigrations in the 20th century. We had looked at a variety of aspects, starting from Germany, remigration of academics, then remigration of political refugees, and then opening the scope of our debates up to other countries, Greece, Bulgaria, France, and also then post-1975 and post-1989 Eastern European countries. And this evening we want to focus our long debate on three life stories, which to a certain extent capture very well the scope of our conference. We have been dealing with biographies more or less for 2 days now, but more from a very structural point of view. Of course, you want to compare groups and see patterns, but I think it's very important in that particular topic that you see the actual lives and the life stories behind this this topic. And so we have invited three very eminent colleagues and people who actually experienced exactly the story we were researching. And I'm very pleased to be able to introduce to you this evening, first on my left, Professor Edgar Feuchtwanger. He comes from a family who had to leave Munich very early in the 30s, and he resided in Munich, as a matter of fact, very close to Hitler's house. And the family settled here in Britain, and he did his education here in Britain and taught history at Southampton University. Interestingly enough, one of his prime focuses on history was biography. He was a master of biography looked at British and German history through the lens of biographies, and eventually also wrote your own autobiography, Erlebnis und Geschichte als Kind in Hitler's Deutschland, Ein Leben in England, sort of as a child in Hitler's Germany and a life in Britain, which appeared in 2011 in Berlin in the publisher Stumke & Humblot, which used to be the family's publishing house. On my right is Georg Stefan Troller. He left Austria, Vienna, in the 30s and emigrated via France to the United States and came back with the American forces first, then later on on a Fulbright scholarship to Paris, tried to settle in Austria, but eventually settled in Paris, from where he became one of the most important journalists of the 60s and 70s, reporting from Paris. All our early television memories are connected with him and his interviewing techniques. And also, he elaborated on the history of his life in a very famous trilogy, Welcome in Vienna, where he basically dealt with interwoven with his own life story. But he is a very prolific writer and journalist and filmmaker. Welcome in Vienna has been shown many times in many TV stations. And finally, on my far right, last but not least, is Jan Kavan, who is son of a Czech diplomat who was here in London, returned to Czechoslovakia, and got into the father into political troubles, and Jan Karwan emigrated after the short spring, Prague spring, back to London, where he became a very important person in resistance, edited a journal. That is always a very important part, and returned later on after 89 to Czechoslovakia, then Czechoslovakia, and became foreign secretary in 1998, and also after 2002, the president of the United Nations General Assembly. He has always strong links to Britain. He is had an honorary professorship, fellowship of the LSE, and I have all the decorations of this panel I have in the biographies, which you, some at least the conference participants can see. And as we are going to talk about lives and biographies, I will cut it short here and leave the rest of the story to my participants here on the panel to tell their own life stories. And what we want to do this evening is basically debate for about three quarters of an hour here on the panel, and then open the discussion up to the floor. I have prepared a couple of rounds of questions, which we can sort of use, or perhaps we can also discuss more freely. And in the first round, I just wanted to ask the three panelists a bit to reflect on the effects of the exile on their personal lives, and perhaps give some short personal introductory statement. Sort of the ideas which we developed also in the conference is what does exile do to your identity? It's a language problem, and it's of course a cultural problem. What sort of how severe is the break, and what are the factors that influence the fact whether it's a break in your identity, or whether perhaps if you are a political refugee, the exile might even strengthen your political identity, or at least it's a part of your identity. Then this sort of more emotional side perhaps is also, what does it actually mean going out but also coming back, sort of when you have made the decision? Marita Kraus and I, who have prepared this this conference, we have worked on borders and crossing of borders as a very symbolic thing. What does it mean, crossing borders, and how was the decision to emigrate actually made? So I suggest that we start sort of somewhat chronologically, perhaps, with the post 40 or the Nazi period, and then go later on into the later periods. And perhaps I just ask Edgar Feuchtwanger on my left whether you want to start.
Okay, I will put my head above the parapet. Can you hear me? Okay. Well, I was 14, I think, when I left Germany. So I could definitely say I was still just young enough to change my identity. It was a sort of change of identity. And I was plunged into a completely different life from what I had led in Munich, as Mr. Chairman has said, in comfortable proximity to Hitler. Anyway, the one thing that I think still did link me to Germany were, of course, my parents, who were also over here. And but it wasn't until probably 1957 that I went back to Germany. It wasn't that easy to travel in a post-war period, and that was the first time I went back with my mother, who was then still alive. My father wasn't. I think my father had seriously contemplated remigrating to Germany because that was really the only place where he could function. But he died before that could happen. He died in 1947. So that's, I think, possibly briefly what happened to me. Perhaps I should leave it like at that for the moment. And I didn't really feel I could in Germany play any kind of role. And when I did go back to Germany a lot in the 60s, I possibly did play a role, but quite inadvertently. I wasn't important enough to play a role, but I established a contact with the University of Frankfurt for various reasons. And, of course, the University of Frankfurt in the 1960s was in the lead in the student movement. The student movement was very strong there, and I won't go into all that. And the contacts I established was probably with the people in the middle, the liberals who were rather in an embattled position at Frankfurt in those days, the liberal professors and so on. And quite without meaning to do so, because as I say, I didn't consider myself important enough to have any political influence, they did find the contact with us important. I think it gave them a sort of lifeline. And the other way around, my colleagues in this country, of course, found what was going on in Germany fascinating, all the turmoil that was going on. And so maybe inadvertently we did have some sort of influence, but remigration for me personally wasn't really a possibility, but contacts back with Germany did become very close and intimate.
Yeah, shall we move on? Georg Stefan Droller.
Well, I was very interested in that you immediately accepted the word exile as being the normal condition of what we were. We never saw ourselves as exiles, but as immigrants. The word exile never entered our thought. Exiles were people like Brecht or Thomas Mann, which we knew that they were going to come back, or various politicians, socialist party politicians and so on, who obviously intended to come back and play a role in post-war Germany or Austria. That was not our case. I never thought about going back. I came to America in 1943 after various, the usual difficulties in getting there. I'm sorry, I made a mistake. 41, I say. And in 43, I joined the American Army. I was drafted into the American Army. I became an American soldier. I did North Africa, Italy, invasion of southern France and Alsace and so on. And we ended in Munich. And I remained for another year in Munich as a part of the American military government, as a journalist, first working for Radio Munich, which was an American propaganda station, of course, and then working for the Neue Zeitung by the editor Hans Habe, which was also an American propaganda medium on a higher level. So I was a returnee in 45, in a Germany, in a post-war Germany from day one. And that was a fascinating experience.
Afterwards, I went back to America to study. All this time, the longing, Heimweh, is there a German English word for that, Herbert? What?
Nostalgia.
Yes.
Homesickness, nostalgia.
My brother, my wife sitting there, they know all about it. It was a deadly disease. It was not being able to feel anything. One had one's feeling attached, especially the Viennese. The Berliners always pretended, but I don't think they were that strongly attached. But the Viennese were. We loved that town. We loved that country. It was part of us, and we were part of them. The loss, the sudden loss by a 16 or 17-year-old boy, as I was, of relatives, home, the boys you went to school with, and all this sort of thing, was an incredible shock. Loss of feelings, because you didn't know what to attach your feelings to. The world had been part of our feelings. At that age, things consist of your own feelings to them. That is gone. And then, no justification for your life. What are you living for? What are you surviving for? Doesn't make sense. Yes? You might as well have not survived. So this was, I think, the general sickness, of at least of the people that I knew, in immigration. And the hope or illusion that once you came back, all this would be reestablished. In other words, you could re-enter your childhood, which, of course, was nonsense. And that we had to find out that this wasn't going to work that way. And then you had to start a completely new life, and that is what I did.
Yeah, thank you very much. So we go for first round.
Yeah. With your permission, I would take slightly more time than my colleagues and try to present my life story, but at the same time answer some of your questions, and then I will fall silent and let the others speak. I was born into, during very highly political times, into a very political family. As it was said, my Czech father had to escape from the Gestapo in March 39 in the then occupied Czechoslovakia. He was pursued by Gestapo as one of the leading Jewish official of the youth organization of the then President Masaryk's National Socialist Party. Then he went to Poland, and after fighting in Poland and fighting in France, he was transferred with the other Czech soldiers to England. And as a soldier emigre, if you wish, he met my English mother here, but returned to the front on the D-Day. Then he was wounded during the siege of Dunkirk and sent for medical treatment back to England. And during that time, he married my mother. At the end of the war, he returned, or if you wish, re-migrated, I don't like the word very much, to Prague, and my mother emigrated, as an English mother emigrated with him. He was then soon posted to the Czechoslovak embassy in London, and therefore I was born here in 1946. In 1950, he was suddenly recalled by the Foreign Office back to Prague, and afterwards, soon afterwards, arrested and sentenced first to life imprisonment, and then it was commuted only to 25 years imprisonment in one of the main Stalinist political trials in the early 50s, when 11 communist leaders were executed. By the time, my father himself was a member of the Communist Party. So I was brought up as a son of a Czech traitor and an English imperialist mother, as my teacher was always described it. And therefore, as a young teenager, I became preoccupied with the need to find out the truth about the political trials and about the need to ensure that what clearly were judicial murders would not be able to happen again, and much more generally with the need to protect justice, human rights, and rule of law, and to project ethical values into political decision-making. Now, I describe this at length in order to explain the type of political motivation which then governed the rest of my life and all my decisions. In the 1960s, I became one of the main student leaders in a movement which led to Prague Spring, and after the Soviet invasion, or Warsaw Pact invasion of Czechoslovakia in August 68, I was very active in the organization of the passive resistance, linking trade unions and the students. And we opposed the new occupation and the concessions-making Czechoslovak government. So in May 69, some of the remaining supporters of Dubček and his so-called socialism with the human face helped me to travel to England, where they thought I could stay until the worst repression would die down. However, the repression accelerated, and so in August 1970, I was faced with the decision whether to return and face a possible imprisonment for my activities or to become an emigre, political emigre in England. And I have to say this was an extremely difficult and traumatic decision, and I proved unable to decide on my own. So using my British passport and a change of name and change of image, I smuggled myself into Czechoslovakia to consult my political friends as to what I should do. And they advised me, if I'm able to escape again, to go to England and stay here to, as they put it, to meet their needs as they would define them and accept the discipline that they know better as to what the opposition would require. So I did exactly that. I became a Czech political emigre, which I think is a more accurate description than to say that a long-lost son returned to his motherland or that I remigrated back to England, which I left when I was 5 years old. Also, my Central European accent meant that all my English friends, of course, perceived me as a Czech emigre, irrespective of my British passport and a British birth certificate. To partly begin to answer your questions, I did not feel any loss of identity. On the other hand, I had no job, no money, and my 4 years of unfinished Czech studies by 69, as opposed to 68, were no longer recognized by British authorities, so I had to start from scratch. But I also devoted from the start my time and energy to help the opposition inside Czechoslovakia. A year later, I had to help to smuggle my mother out of Czechoslovakia just a week before she was supposed to be arrested for her own opposition's activities, etc., etc. I studied here, graduated from LSE, and then went to Oxford, but I abandoned my postgraduate studies in order to devote all my time to help the human rights opposition, because unlike some of my colleagues, I actually believed, naively maybe, that my stay here is a temporary one, and that I shall return back as soon as it will be possible. I helped to link all the main opposition groups in Poland, the then Czechoslovakia and Hungary, and also later East Germany, and helped to establish an organization which overseed that cooperation. I think it only strengthened my understanding of my political aims and my determination to help the human rights groups throughout Eastern Europe. However, in order to preserve my political independence, I refused to accept any offers from any intelligence organizations, be they British, American, or any other, and therefore was going from large debt to even larger debt. and therefore had to establish a large circle of friends and supporters who partly helped us to get financial support for smuggling things into Czechoslovakia and Poland and elsewhere, but also as volunteers to travel as couriers or drivers of my smuggling vans. Many of them were British, some were French. The British were primary members of the Labour Party, and some were members of even Trotskyist groups. I myself used the fact that you can change your name and that I was entitled to British passport, and I traveled to Poland, Hungary, and later to East Berlin to link up the oppositions. And we helped to create the first ever cooperation across the East European borders, which led to the first ever joint political statements, programmatic statements of Charter 77, Solidarność, Hungarian Democratic Opposition, East German Opposition, and so on. At the beginning, as I said, the beginning of my stay here, I believed that it would be temporary. I wrongly guessed that it might be similar to Hungary, that 6 years after 56 were the nastiest years, and then the repression was reduced, and therefore I believe maybe 6-7 years and I will return. In fact, 6 years is about the time that my father spent in England during the war in emigration. However, I was wrong, and I stayed here for 20 years. I didn't get much support from my compatriots, because most of my compatriots during the 20 years decided that the best thing to do is to integrate into the British society and to cut the umbilical cord to their home country. However, as people on the panel here know, life of a political emigre is not an easy one. Feeling of isolation, occasional doubts concerning a hopeless struggle. No one believed me when I said communism will not last forever. Lack of professional career, lack of a family. I didn't believe I should start a family, which I would then have to uproot, and so on and so on. However, when in 1989 the Czechoslovak government, communist government, began to crumble, unlike the traumatic decision to emigrate, as you asked, the decision to re-emigrate, it took me, I think, about 4 or 5 minutes. I don't even remember if it took me 4 minutes. I think it was an immediate decision. Because from my point of view, that was simple. I mean, my purpose to emigrate was fulfilled. There was no longer any sense in staying in England. So I was the first Czech re-emigre to return on 25th of November 1989. I was detained at the airport, interrogated for 17 hours. I do remember one of the, while the radio at the back was going on, describing one of the first big demonstrations in Prague. My interrogators were very nervous, and their chief called me one of the main protagonists of the change which is now taking place. 17 hours later, they actually allowed me to go into the city. I put myself into the hotel, and the next day they picked me up in the hotel and drove me to one of their conspiratorial villas for more interrogation, which they secretly filmed on a video, which 3 years later was then used to discredit me. I had no idea that this was being filmed. Anyway, within a few days of returning, I was elected to the leadership of the Civic Forum organization which carried out the revolution. And 7 months later, I was elected in the first free elections to the parliament, to the Federal Assembly. However, a few months later, I was accused of being a former agent of the Communist Secret Service. And it took me full 5 years of legal struggles to clear my name. And during those 5 years, I became the main target of the media, which at that time was dominated by very young, very fanatical rightist journalists. And the vicious campaign left, I think, a lasting impact on the people up to date, irrespective of the fact that I was cleared by the court. Because while it is possible to get formally cleared. In court, it is impossible to wipe off the suspicion out of people's minds, especially given 5 years of a permanent media campaign. And this was encouraged by the media, which suggested that I was cleared by the court, not because I was innocent, but because there was lack of evidence of my guilt. And people find it easy to believe such absurd accusations. Because first of all, as it was said here during the previous days, emigres were perceived as people who escaped from the misery which the nation suffered from. And people believed that we here in the prosperous West were having very good time and were rich and well off while they suffered. In fact, very few of them suffered, because if you conformed, the regime was treated you fairly well, and not many of us lived a life of luxury here. However, the truth is irrelevant. Perception is what is important. A certain envy, I think, colored people's perceptions. The only returnees, as I call them, and remigrants, I think this conference calls them, who were welcomed and decorated, were those emigres who could prove a kind of a history of fully supporting the USA, i.e. the victors of the Cold War. If they could even suggest that they cooperated with the CIA, that was extremely helpful. Because friends of the new victorious great power were perceived by people that they offer a certain promise that the new democracy will become more prosperous and will secure, will give security to all. However, emigres who in the West were associated with the left were automatically under great suspicion. People incessantly were asking me, how could I escape from communism and then join the Labour Party and become critical of Margaret Thatcher when the Iron Lady actually led, together with a little bit of help of Ronnie Reagan, led the courageous and victorious struggle against the evil communists. They couldn't understand when Maggie Thatcher came to Prague to actually declare this nonsense that she actually won the Cold War and she addressed the Federal Parliament, of which I was a member. People couldn't understand that I actually made a speech in which I was critical of certain aspects of Thatcherism, which then proved to be fatal because it drew attention to myself and I became therefore the target of the campaign I mentioned. I think this absurdity made sense to people trying to understand my motivation. If it could be explained that, in fact, all the time while I was emigre here, I actually acted under the instructions of the Czech Communist Secret Service. Conspiratorial way of thinking in the early 90s prevailed absolutely everywhere. 2 years after the so-called Velvet Revolution, the dissidents and Charter 77 became, I would put it mildly, uncomfortable, not officially, but in reality. There were an increasing number of articles which suggested that Charter 77 was in fact infiltrated heavily by Secret Service people, by communists. And this idea somehow reassured those who were conformists and who conformed to the regime and refused to help the Charter, it reassured them that, in fact, there were no cowards by refusing to help the opposition. In fact, they were extremely clever because they were able to see through the camouflage. So it helped to justify conformity and made them feel much better. I remember the then Czech Prime Minister, Petr Pithart, argued that the dissidents were, in fact, kind of a walking mirror and unwittingly forced people to look at this mirror and to realize that, in fact, to be a dissident during the 70s and 80s was not so dangerous and it was feasible, wasn't comparable to the 1950s. And therefore, it was uncomfortable. Therefore, to remove them from public life also meant to remove them from being so such an uncomfortable reminder of their conformity. So by 1992, with the exception of Václav Havel, all of them were removed from positions of power, and you had the same procedures in Poland, in Hungary, and elsewhere. So it's not a Czech specialty.
Excuse me, could I just interrupt?
Yes.
Since you said we should talk to each other. Yes?
Yeah, mm. We can.
Okay, let me just therefore conclude. On 2 points. One, I did help while I was here to establish these links between Czechs, Poles, Hungarians, East Germans, etc. In fact, those networks, as networks were discussed here, proved to be very helpful after 89. And in fact, more or less the same people which organized, which I helped to link together, then created the Visegrad Group in 1990. It lasted only 2 years before it was changed, but it was one thing. And last, second point, I think one of your questions you asked to compare 45 and 89. I remember when I was first accused in 91, I had kind of a feeling of deja vu, because my father, same as me, emigrated to England. Same as me, he returned home after the enemy was defeated. Same as me, he was unjustly accused by his own party that he worked with the enemy. Same as me, he was accused of being a traitor. But in the 1990s, the revolution devoured its children in a much more humane manner. There were no executions, no prisons, but it was just discrimination, social ostracism, etc. Different methods, but I would argue a very similar principles. Similar fear that those who spend a lot of time in the West were nationally unreliable, something which President Klaus publicly said about myself when he pointed out, even when I was president of the United Nations General Assembly, I shouldn't be really believed that I would help Czech national interest, because I was born in England and spent 20 years in the UK. Therefore, my Czechness, so to speak, should be put in doubt.
Okay, thank you very much. Do you want directly question to that, or?
I felt that we shouldn't go into politics. This was not the purpose of this symposium.
Well, then let me ask you, you mentioned before the sort of the deadly disease of Heimweh, homesickness, and or nostalgia. What did it actually mean for you to come back to first Munich and then particularly Vienna? Was that a point where you made a decision that you actually wanted to return to Europe? I mean, you could have returned to the United States. Was that the particular point, or on the other hand, or a second question in that nostalgia is more about social relations and feeling at home, but there could also be a political agenda. And you became a very political journalist afterwards. Did you have the feeling that you had a job to do?
I was studying at the University of California. I was very happy as a student. I was deep into Shakespeare, Elizabethan, and all this sort of thing. And the professor asked us what we saw our future as, you know. And at that moment, they had started a film school at the University of California, and I submitted a film script, or the idea to a film script. And I could at that moment have become, I guess, a Hollywood film author of the second rank. And it occurred to me all of a sudden, did I really want that? Is that what I wanted? And what was it that I wanted? I don't think it was such a conscious self-questioning, but it was a feeling inside me that I wanted something else.
And that other thing had to do, not necessarily with Austria or Germany or anything like that, but it had to do with Europe, and it had to do with the German language. I think that the language problem for... I became a filmmaker afterwards, yes, for German television. I did that for 40 years. Language, I felt, was, at least for me, the only possible road towards identity, towards feeling at one with myself. I had to write in my language, and my language, much as I adored English, and I still do, could not be that. It had to be the childhood language. It had to be the language into which every word corresponded to a feeling, or 10 feelings. And at that moment, something in me unconsciously must have decided to come back to Europe. I became a filmmaker also because the German language, which I loved, which was my language, my medium of expression, had been corrupted utterly by the Nazis. It was not a language into which, as I thought, one could express our own feelings. It was the language of the Nazis. Pictures were innocent. Film pictures, of course, you directed them, you made them, you saw them, you realized them, had a certain independence of what the Nazis were about. Of course, they had made films, good films, bad films, and all this sort of thing, but by and large, the film language and the photo language was democratic. And that is what I tended towards. In viewing backwards, it looks as if it had been a conscious decision, but it was not that. It was just something inside me, and the most important things happened that way anyway in your lives. Something in you want something, and you get it, or you die getting it, or you are unhappy for the rest of your life if you don't get it. And so that is what my way became. Did I want to improve the German mentality, if that's what we are going to be talking about here?
Well, if you're a journalist and you interview politicians and you met many people and you interviewed them very critically, so mainly something about truth or at least...
Germany, as I found it in 45, was a deeply corrupted country. Even the non-Nazis, and everyone was a non-Nazi, we know that. Even they were deeply corrupted, and some of them still are. The average figure, I think, is now estimated to 20% or 25% of Nazis, neo-Nazis, or people who feel that the Jews are getting too much power in this world and all this sort of thing. Yes, I wanted to influence that, but I did not want to influence that by preaching or by politics. I'm sorry, it's not
okay,
my...
No problem.
Not, wasn't my way. But by truth-talking, also by showing myself as I really was, with all my faults and weaknesses and all that, show what there is, show the truth, show reality, show not heroism, not this fairy tale world that the Nazis had all been living in because there was a complete imagining. None of the things that the Nazis proclaimed had a reality, and one had to bring them back to reality. Of course, they were eager for that. That was my astonishing discovery. As soon as I arrived in Germany on the end of April 1945, they were all desperate for reality, or they claimed to be. And that was the way it was going to be with me. And again, unconsciously, that is what I wanted to show them what things were really like, and not what they had believed to be right. But not in politics, not in political articles or anything like that, but by showing and later on writing things as they were, because the sense of reality is the one thing that was really lacking in the German mentality. So that was my way.
Thank you. Perhaps I can turn to Edgar Feuchtwanger again, perhaps with two questions. You mentioned before that you think you might have been quite important as a broker between the British community of historians and the German ones. But what actually did the frequent returns and early returns to Germany mean to you personally? You were obviously those 2 years younger, or you didn't return to Germany as a soldier, and your life was more determined by the family constellation. But returning to Germany must have been important to your family, to you personally, and also, again, the decision to become a historian and work on topics of German history, also British history, but German history was very important to you as well, and you wrote important books on that. So what was the drive behind that?
Well, when I went back to Germany the first time in the 1950s, I had very mixed feelings. I knew I wasn't really a stranger. I couldn't be that. But on the other hand, I was in a way an outsider. I had become an outsider. That's what I felt. Some of the things that our colleague here has just said made me think back to my earlier youth in Germany, the corruption. I was a teenager, and I was in the middle of the Nazis. I could look out of the window, I could be in the street. Here was Hitler getting into his cars. I seen Rome. I've seen all Hitler's Munich cronies, like his photographer Hoffmann. I used to see him going out of his underground garage in his gleaming silver Mercedes when I went to school. And yet here was I, Feuchtwanger, the nephew of Leon Feuchtwanger, who was enemy number one practically amongst the intellectuals. And it was, I think when I look back on it now, I could see why people got corrupted. Even from my position, when as a child I knew perfectly well, this was a great danger to me and to my family, and we were absolutely against it. I was somehow not completely able to resist it, shall we say, or to resist its fascination, let's put it that way. That's one of the comments I would make.
And what did coming back, returning to Germany, is that more a family experience? Or, I mean, it must have been difficult.
Well, the curious thing was that my mother's generation and her brother and her sister-in-laws, who were, after all, the sister of Leon Feuchtwanger, public enemy number one of the Nazi, they all went back to Germany in the late 50s. They spent the summer there. They almost tried to reestablish their previous life, not to remigrate, but it was part of the persona, I would say. I wasn't quite with that because I was too young. I sort of felt in between being, as I say, a stranger, but not a complete stranger either. That's what I felt.
Did you ever go to California to see your uncle?
I never saw my uncle, but I saw my aunt, yes, who lived much longer than he did.
Yes.
But I was going to, I don't know if I may do that, draw attention to, you know, the literary exiles that first went to Sanary in the south of France and then later to California. And as far as I can gather, when they were in Sanary, there was the whole Mann family, and Brecht came to visit my uncle and aunt quite frequently, never lived there. I think they thought initially, certainly, they were on a short lease. It would all fold up. They had that illusion, you know. And then when they found it wasn't like that, and it got desperate. I mean, one can see it in Thomas Mann's article, Brother Hitler, and so on. And then in California, of course, they were drawn close together, I think. My uncle was very close always to Heinrich Mann. He came to be close to Golo Mann, with whom he was for a time hidden in by the American consul in Marseille in 1940, and so on. And most of them remigrated. My uncle, for various reasons, which I could explain, didn't. Anyway, I'll leave it at that. Maybe people want to ask me questions about it.
Perhaps I can go back on the panel one more time and ask a bit more detailed about your experience with the being a journalist in post-war Germany. Firstly, as you mentioned, with the basically American propaganda or forces, but soon you got an important role in as a journalist in general. Was that difficult? I mean, did you feel accepted as this voice looking critically, or did
well,
you, amongst the colleagues? I mean,
I had a very typical experience early on. First, I worked for 10 years for German radio. First, I worked for the Marshall Plan, Voice of America and all that, and that gave me contact with German radio stations. I worked for radio, later on television. I went to see the man in charge of the news department at Südwestfunk Baden-Baden. Very nice man, all that. They were all anti-Nazis.
Of course.
Down to the core. And while I was talking to him, and he said, oh, wonderful, you do something for us from Paris and all that, the phone rang and he picked it up and said, my God, Kristallnacht again? We have to do something about that, damn it. And I said, calm down. I was there. I can tell you all about it. And he said, oh, no, no, no. No, oh, no, 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 not eyewitnesses account. No, no, what we want is an article, someone who can write an article from the level of how awful those German Nazis were. Never again will anything like that happen, and all that. but we certainly don't want anyone to tell us the truth. And that was very, very, that must have been in the 60s, yes? Mm. I think this was Germany in the 60s. Write all about it, but don't live through it. Don't suffer through it. Don't believe that this is part of you. Don't identify with it, you know? But, of course, we can write about it. Ah, oh, those awful Nazis and the terrible and all this sort of thing. And that saves us, saves our souls, yes? That way, we don't have to deal with ourselves, with our own past. Each one of them felt that. If only he could write an article like that, or read an article like that, which is almost as good, yes? When it said, oh, those awful Nazis, and say, yeah, he'd say to his wife, yes, yes, when the Nazis are awful, and she'd say, yes, yes. And that way you save your soul. You don't have to deal with yourself. And that was the German trouble after the war. They did not want to deal with their own sins, with their own crimes. And their way of avoiding that was to feel how awful, terrible it is. I was there at the liberation of Dachau, concentration camp. The American army took busloads of Munich people to the camp, and I was there. They held handkerchiefs in front of their noses because those dead people who were still lying around there smelled. And one woman said to me, can I say it in German first?
Yeah.
Das hätte er uns auch nicht antun brauchen. That you shouldn't have done to us. She felt they had already suffered enough having to look at all those dead, you know. And now that smell, that was too much. The general idea in Germany was we have had the Russians, the Ivan, as they all said, yes. We've had the bombing nights, RAF and all this sort of thing. So we have paid the price, and now for God's sake, leave us alone. To have to push them with their noses in the dirt to try remembering what really happened and what they really did started in 1968. And not before that.
Can I perhaps have one follow-up question? We open it for in a minute. You left the United States quite early again and stayed mostly in Europe, but do you have the feeling that the years there were of important personal impact on you? I mean, what sort of... what's the importance of that experience for your outlook or perhaps also the network of people you keep in contact with?
Well, I went back to Austria first, and I wanted to study theater arts, which was my specialty at the time, in the Hofburg, in the Imperial Residence. That's where the officers were. And to my amazement, the director of the theater arts compartment was Professor Kindermann, who had been a terrible Nazi in the war years, and everyone knew about him. So, being a specialist, they kept him on. And then there was a list of each one of the students was supposed to do one short talk on any one of those important German or Austrian dramatists that we were going to deal with. And to my amazement, I found that the Nazis were mixed in with the non-Nazis or the anti-Nazis or the immigrants without making any difference. They're all authors, they're all writers, they all suffered in their souls, didn't they? And I rebelled against that. I revolted against that. That is somehow not right. And that was when? 49. In the autumn of 49. No one had the slightest idea. I mean, they were all very nice and friendly, you can imagine. To me, too.
But no one had the slightest idea that there was anything wrong with mixing in the Nazis and the anti-Nazis. That didn't occur to them. And that was one of my decisive experiences. Then I went to France. France had their own problems, God knows. Also their own problems under the German occupation, God knows. But it wasn't the same kind of people.
Perhaps I can ask you a similar question. 20 years in exile, you have experienced a lot of, well, partly isolation, which you sort of told us all about, very moving words, but on the other hand, you have friends and networks. And is that a sort of a social capital or a resource to a certain extent which helped you later on as a returnee? And what does it actually mean to you, this sort of living basically in two countries, two societies, or in basically in also two circles of friends?
It helped tremendously. I established very wide circle of friends here, primarily political friends, but not only. And I was very glad that during the worst years of the campaigns against me in Prague, practically all my friends from my exile days, is that how you want to describe them, expressed public support for me, from journalists all the way to Minister of Foreign Affairs, Foreign Secretary Robin Cook at the time, in many. And that was a fantastic help. Same help as, in fact, during those difficult years, with the one or two exceptions, practically all the hardcore dissidents, those who spent years in prison, up to 9-10 years in prison, all came up defending me. So those who were accusing me or believing in the accusations were frequently people who didn't see a dissident from a train or from a distance, who were conformists and didn't take part in the opposition at all. In fact, listening to you, let me just say that many people, when I returned, what was interesting, one of the things didn't surprise me, because in 1945, my father also explained to me when he returned back from the war to liberated Prague, suddenly there were no collaborators. Everybody was partisan and everybody was fighting the Nazis, which was very surprising. When I returned back, there were no communists. There were, everybody was in the opposition. And as you said, people didn't want to deal with their own sins. I think that's exactly what I did find out. Everybody was suddenly courageous. And many former leading communists overnight became anti-communists, and even today are in very important positions, and are, in fact, one of the richest people in the country, because they also had the know-how and the stacked away money which they could invest. So in a way, it's not that different, some of our experiences, despite the time gap and different countries. But the fact, to last answer your question, the fact that I maintained those dissident friends I used to help for 20 years there, which they appreciated, and the friends I had here, helped me to overcome the trauma of the accusations. And differently, when I became foreign minister and deputy prime minister, I suddenly had my job made much easier, because I suddenly had enormous amount of international contacts, which people remembered.
That's a final question to you, Edgar Feuchtwanger. You once said you still, even though you're probably the one who was integrated most in the society of emigration, you said you always felt a bit like an outsider. What is it? What was the missing bit?
Well, you see, a whole sort of range of socialization that you would normally have had. I mean, that I would have had in German literature and this, that, and the other. I didn't have, because it was cut off at 14. I was just about young enough not to really... to this day, I don't know as much about German literature and about all sorts of things that I would have known had I lived there, but I didn't live there. I have to say, I wasn't a remigre. I didn't remigrate ever. And my experience of then meeting Germans is, I think, slightly different from both my colleagues' experience, in that, for example, I visited an industrialist in North Germany, in Hanover, who was deeply implicated in the Nazi thing, as he had to be, you know, being a big industrialist who... works for producing war things, and who was employing forced labor, 10,000 of them, and who had to go through denazification proceedings after the war. And I came to visit because they were friends of my family, and I didn't mention a thing about all this. We just had tea and everything was nice. And suddenly he started to justify himself. I mean, he said, I couldn't do anything else. Things like that. And I was frankly embarrassed. I didn't want to raise the subject at all. But... I listened, and I felt he was getting a lot of things off his chest, which he couldn't get off his chest to other people, but he could get it off his chest to me. And, well, I bore it manfully.
I but suppose he would have had other opportunities as well.
He might have had, but that was more my sort of experience. And otherwise, I only really met people of whom I knew they weren't really implicated, you know, or if they were only very marginally. So,
you said somewhere that emigrating was an adventure for you.
Yes.
Yes, so it was for me. Yeah. That's absolutely true.
I mean, kids
being able to get out from their parents is about the best thing that can happen to them.
Yeah. I had only been out of Upper Bavaria once when I went to Berlin in 1937, which was actually quite a pleasant experience, I found. I was 12 then. And when I suddenly, you know, saw the sea for the first time at the Hoek van Holland, and then on the Cornish Riviera somewhere around Dawlish, I thought it was great. Yeah, I thought it was very exciting. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. I think we stop on the panel here and open to the floor. I've already had several indications of people wanting to ask questions. We have two microphones, and it would be great if you could use the microphones. Just it makes it easier to understand. So the first, Thomas Kuhlinger.
Thanks a lot. I guess my question is directed at the three panelists together. You've all built such tremendously impressive careers after the years of immigration, of exile, which, to my mind, always stands heroic against the background of what you suffered, what you went through. Now, Stefan Troller did actually admit that immigration was an adventure, so that half takes the sting out of my question, because I was going to ask you, all three of you, in the various generations you belong to, was there not a feeling of resentment towards the countries that you came from as you grow older, despite the adventure that you experience and the job.
Feeling of resentment.
Resentment towards the country that did this to you and your family and your friends, despite the adventure that you experienced and the job you had and the feeling of a mission almost, journalism, academia, and politics. That's very impressive, but there must have been a sort of block, a mental block towards your own country that you could never quite cope with. You could never quite 100% make your peace, or could you, with the countries of your origin? I'm very curious, because I myself am a refugee, and the refugee is a totally different category from Danzig. But my adolescent years were fraught with danger and with problems of coping with the country we were from. Did you have similar reservations, which would have been natural?
Yes, I think there was resentment. But I have to say, I think the resentment, particularly latterly in my case, has rather gone, because my contacts with Germany are nowadays very frequent all the time. It's partly due to the internet age. One can, you know, it's all on my computer, and since I get drawn back into it anyhow because of my father and my uncle and all these connections with Germany, I now take it in my stride, I would say. I have no resentment left, really. But initially, yes, I thought, who are these people in the streets? What were they really doing when all this was happening? Thoughts like that did cross my mind. But as I say, they've gradually subsided, I would say.
In this film trilogy, we've been talking about, I have long, this is really a story of my life. There are long discussions about this, and here I am, played by an actor, asking his friend, why do we have to love the country that hates us? Or why do we have to love the people who hate us? I think that is more to the point than simple resentment or hatred or anything like that. The incomprehension why people whom we really felt more or less identical with had started hating us. That is the question we asked ourselves. It's resentment's too easy. It's also an explanation that's too easy and something that's always being pushed our way. People are always asking me, don't you hate the Germans and all that? That's too easy. That isn't really the way it worked. It was despair, incomprehension, and couldn't understand why writers whom one had adored all of a sudden, in our country, Weinheber, Max Mell, why all of a sudden they wrote anti-Jewish pamphlets, why they had to write poems to Hitler, haben a Mann, wie können wir dir danken? Magnificent man, how can we ever thank you? Well, if he didn't know, I certainly didn't know.
Yeah, Kevin.
I have to say, unlike what my colleague said, emigration for me was not an adventure. Just the contrary. I enjoyed my British friends very much, but I didn't like the fact that I am an emigre at all. And in fact, I felt resentment not towards Czechoslovakia, but towards the regime which I had to flee. I felt resentment against the Soviet leadership which ordered the invasion, to factors which in my mind caused my emigration, which I did not like.
But the regime was all too often identical with the people.
No, I always have separated the regime from the people. And the people always had great ability to pretend that they never were part of any regime. As I said, I mean, today it's very difficult to find anyone who would tell you that they supported the communist regime, including top communists. And today I do feel certain resentment against people who deny what really happened, distort even the recent history of the dissident movement, and who are really terribly corrupt. One of my main problems in Czech politics is the widespread corruption and the fact that people no longer feel that corruption is anything wrong. I mean, it is a way of survival. It's normal. In fact, if you... people criticize me for giving examples from Britain or from Sweden, which I know well, about anti-corruption measures which are accepted in these countries, and people think this is stupid. I mean, why should you do that? I mean, corruption is all right. It makes us all fairly rich, and anti-corruption will make our life difficult. This is clearly the result of you spending 20 years in a foreign country. I resent that, but I don't resent the country as such, and I feel sometimes pity for people who conform to almost any regime. But to actually say, use a phrase of resentment of my country, I wouldn't use that phrase, no.
Yeah.
Thank you. Can you hear me? Jeffrey Hosking, School of Slavonic Studies. I wanted to ask all the panelists...
Could you stand up, please?
Oh, yes, certainly. I'd be happy to stand up. I wanted to draw a bit on the Russian experience and see how it compares with your experience. From the Soviet Union, the first and third waves of immigration, the first was during revolution and civil war and during the early 1920s, and then the third wave was from the 1960s onwards. They were both very educated generations, and they knew quite a lot about the countries to which they moved. I mean, a lot of émigrés went to France, for example, knowing French very well, and understanding French culture well, and the 1960s generation also. But when they got to the lands where they resettled, they found that life wasn't quite as easy as they anticipated because they lacked the everyday sense of how to conduct yourself in a foreign country. They lacked the body language, the sort of easy interpretation of people's gestures and things of this kind. And I wondered if that had been your experience. And then... Of course, the first generation never went back, but the third generation had the opportunity to go back after the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, and yet a lot of them did not do so. They chose to stay in the West. Sometimes this was for family reasons, entirely understandable, but sometimes it was because of the instability and the poverty of life in post-Soviet Russia. And some of those who did go back found life there extremely difficult for the same reasons, but also because they'd spent a long time abroad and had lost the easy sense of what life was like in Russia. So I wondered if those had been your experiences too, or anything similar.
You want to start again?
I start from the end, if I remembered all the questions. As was said here by Sarah Schneider earlier, as far as Czechoslovakia is concerned, or the Czech emigration, the majority of emigres stayed in the West even after 1989. Some of them do come and visit, including my own brother, who is a professor at the University of Sussex here, but refused to return. But they have no problems in coming and visit. But they come as interested visitors, as foreigners, as Westerners. And it would never occur to them after 20 years of settling here. And in fact, going through this very traumatic, difficult way of integrating into a different society. Yeah, my brother, because he was also born here, an English mother, etc., knew quite a lot about Britain, same as I did when we arrived here. But exactly as you said, it doesn't mean that you then learn the everyday gestures, the mannerisms, the idioms, and etc. And it takes 20 years to fully integrate. But in order to fully integrate, you have to cut the umbilical cord to your own country. You have to dream in your new language. Now, if you manage to do that, then to return back is very, very difficult. Those of us who emigrated for purely political reasons, perceived ourselves as politicos here, as was said here earlier, for us it was much easier. I never cut the umbilical cord to my own country, and therefore it took me a few minutes to decide to return. But I do understand that I represent 10%, if that, of the emigration. And your first question, no, I think that,
Do you want to take up?
Well, I think returns were very rare in the first years after the war, and it's only after the 60s that Jewish emigres started to return. And there, one thing I noticed was that they were accepted, like I'm thinking of public figures like in Austria, like Thorberg or Weigel, who edited magazines, who worked in cabarets, who were writers and so on. They were accepted when they were just as anti-communist as the Austrians or the Germans had always been. When they could blow into the same trumpet, they were accepted, not 100%, but let's say 50%. If not, not. And let me add this, that the Socialist Party in Austria wrote to the socialist functionaries who had emigrated to America letters saying, hopefully you don't think about returning to this country, because else the Socialist Party is going to be called a Jew party all over again, like it had before the war.
Well, I think I've answered it already. I mean, when I go to Germany nowadays, I am a foreigner in a way, but not quite a foreigner either. I think the massive contacts one has now as a result of the internet and the computer and being, I much rather, as I said to you, watch Maybrit Illner's than Jonathan Dimbleby. I think she's got a much better format, so I know quite a lot of things. But some things, of course, I don't know at all, because I haven't been there and so on. So
I
it's a mixture.
I disagree on the last point. Ricardo Babay. Yeah.
I was struck by your distinction between language and pictures and their relation to reality. So you said that the German language was actually your source of identity, and that was one of the reasons why you came back to Europe. However, the German language had been badly polluted, of course. And then you turned to pictures, you said, because they were somehow innocent or even democratic, which reminded me of what John Hartfield or Kurt Tucholsky were actually saying in the 1920s when they worked for the Arbeiter Illustrierte Zeitung, that this, you know, the relationship between pictures and reality would be a very immediate one. However, pictures, of course, had also been badly polluted, in a sense, during the Third Reich. So my question would be, what kind of pictures were you actually showing, and where your belief in the kind of in pictures as being the true representative of reality came from? And then afterwards, of course, you turn to the German language anyway as a writer, and how you kind of try to cleanse the German language of that pollution.
That's two difficult questions.
Well, one thing I'll say is that I started filming with the love of pictures. Eisenstein was the great influence of my life. I wanted to make silent films, like now they have a silent film that just won all the Oscars.
And then it turned out, to my amazement and to my disgust, that people, were, when they talked about me, I've made 180 films, please, they were always talking to me about how wonderful my texts were, when I was so proud of my pictures. So that was one way. The other way of dealing with these returnee questions was my personal way of that I've lived in Paris now for 60 years, and that I became a sort of Paris specialist to the German public. Paris was, after the war, what Rome was at the time of Goethe. It was some sort of paradise of easy living, good cooking, and great sex. And so there was Toller talking about Paris. So by the detour of filming and talking for 10 years and more in a show that was called Paris Journal, Paris Journal, I could talk about the things that I was personally interested in the language, in the filmic, and in the literal language that I was absolutely personally interested in, while still everyone thought I was only talking about Paris. So that was a trick that I used unconsciously, again, to warm my way into the heart of the German public.
Yeah. Yes.
You want? Okay, sorry about that. One thing which you all share.
Could you?
Sorry. Yeah. One thing that you all share somewhere, some sense of a Jewish formation and a kind of national identity, three different original national identities. And I was wondering to what extent you thought that Jewish identity was important then or now or not at all, and what extent it had also, not just in terms of your own experience, but to what extent people projected or assumed things about you as a Jewish, quote, returnee or re-emigrant?
Well, I would say way back in the Third Reich, the experience reinforced my Jewish identity, quite obviously. I mean, that was so for a lot of people. I nowadays feel I retain it. I wouldn't for a minute wish to say I haven't got it, but I don't know whether now it's such a very determining factor in the way I look at things, or certainly in the way I return to Germany, because it's all a bit over the horizon, I think, all these things. One is very old, and the people who are around now are much younger, so the whole scenery has shifted, as it were. So that's my feeling.
Well, we're getting towards what I think was supposed to be the last question. How did exile help us? And yes, being at the same time Viennese, Jewish, American, even French and German through my writing, is, to my amazement, a fantastic bonus. While as a young man, I thought and was convinced by my heritage and all that, that unless you belonged to one place, to one language, to one country, to one people, you were a, what did they, Russians call it, cosmopolitan. Well, now,
yes, cosmopolitan.
I think most people are desperate to become cosmopolitans, aren't they? Everyone wants to belong to different countries. Everyone wants to have been in Thailand and God knows where else, yes? and to have lived the life of the people there and all that, show what we lived in advance of the others, and which we thought of as being a tragedy, turned out to be a boon, including being Jewish.
It's
not an easy one. I remember the very few years I spent with my father, because most of my childhood he was in prison, and then he came out of prison very ill and died very young at the age of 46. But the short time I did have to talk to him about this experience in the war, one of the things I remembered when he was partly joking about his experience in the Czechoslovak army, which was fighting with the British, he said the problem in the army were twofold. One, they had very few people who could become privates, because in the army, if you had university education, you were entitled to be an officer. So it was an army of officers, and sometimes some of these officers had to play the role of privates. And the second problem was it was difficult to find a non-Jew there. It was basically an army of Czech Jewish officers. When he got, he was twice wounded, and when he was in the hospital recovering, he said in the room there was no one but officers who were all Jewish, with no exception. I remember of course, when that one of the subjects he was very reluctant to talk about, even when my mother asked him his feeling when with the army he came to liberate a concentration camp, and in the office of the commandant they find a list of people who were sent to gas chambers only recently, and he found the name of his mother. So I was brought up sort of being aware that although my father was Jewish but didn't stress that it was a very sensitive subject. In the 50s, when people were being arrested, including the main trial, the anti-Semitism was extremely strong. I remember as a small kid when I was reading about these traitors, with very few exceptions, after the description of a traitor, it said a Zionist, i.e. every Jew was automatically a Zionist. However, today it's the very and at that time a lot of people accept it. I remember as a small kid when I was first beaten up in the school, they shouted at me that I'm a Jewish Bolshevik, which I didn't understand the combination at all. And people accepted it. Today it's the very opposite. People again switched. Recently I had a major problem when I was critical of certain policies by current Israeli government. Suddenly, a person whom I know to be basically anti-Semitic and a non-Jew accused me of being anti-Semitic because I am critical of certain concrete policies of the Israeli government. And he then repeated it on television as a matter of fact. These simplifications and these things I find very, very difficult to reconcile with, so I'm very careful in making pronouncements on these issues.
Yeah, final question.
Last question, Doris Heil. Have you forgiven...
Could you use the microphone, please?
Doris Heil, have you forgiven the countries of your birth for the disruption in your life? It seems to me that forgiveness in a Christian sense or an intellectual sense is the basis for a happy and contented life. And can I say, Mr. Feuchtwanger, you give me the impression that you have forgiven.
Yes, I think I can say that. I can agree.
Is that the word you would use?
No one is happy before his death. It's a Roman proverb. No one is happy. No one can say he's happy before he dies. But you know what's going to happen. You know, illness and losses and
everything is still possible in your life. But as regards my having come through from an impossible, unjustified life to something that I can justify and be slightly proud of, yes.
That a category would...
I don't think I would use the word forgiveness. And anyway, because you said the country where you were born, I was born in London. I have nothing to either blame or forgive United Kingdom for. And in fact, I was very glad, very glad that England accepted me in 1969. In fact, I pretended to be a Czech emigre while British authorities regarded me as a long-lost son who returned. And as far as Czechoslovakia is concerned, it didn't treat me well. Didn't treat my father well either, which I resented. But I resented the regime, not the country. The country for me is history, it's culture, which I still greatly admire, and I have nothing to forgive. But I would agree that with you, that with the proverb, nobody will be fully, not only happy, but even contented before one dies, and definitely applies to me. I won't.
Thank you. I think you mentioned a very important fact. You said you're very grateful to Britain that they accepted you, that you were here, and I think we shouldn't forget that we are the country which has an extremely long tradition of receiving emigres, exiles, of all nationalities, of all for all reasons, yes. And this institute itself wouldn't be where we are or where it is if it wasn't for the emigres who then re-established and reconnected with the people who drove them out. And so this is a very historic place for a debate like this, and I'm very grateful to all my panelists that have agreed to share their life stories so openly with us, and all of you. I would also like to thank for coming and discussing it with us, and we have now the opportunity to continue our talks next door in our library over wine and some food. So you're all very welcome to join us next door, and thank you very much for coming, and safe journey home, and good weekend. Thank you.